Glenn Beck.
Two words I can't believe I'm saying them today. Donald Trump delivered. And here's why I can't believe I'm saying this. You know, I've
three words, technically. Just want to make that.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Trump delivered. Sorry. I'm not good with math. The reason why I say I can't believe it is, you know, I've said I'm going to call him out when he's wrong. I'm going to call him as I see him. And I'll praise him when he was right. There's no way in hell. I think I'm on record saying there's no way in hell he's going to do any of this with Israel. He did it. He formally recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and vowed to move the U.S. embassy to the holy city of Jerusalem.
Through all of these years, presidents representing the United States have declined to officially recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. In fact, we have declined to acknowledge any Israeli capital at all. But today we finally acknowledge the obvious, that Jerusalem is Israel's capital. This is nothing more or less than a recognition of reality. It is also the right thing to do. It's something that has to be done.
Okay. All right. It's going to end the same way as the Ronald Reagan thing did, either in horrific flames of fire or really good things. Ronald Reagan stepped to the plate and said, this is an evil empire. It needs to be destroyed. That was a pretty brave and bold statement to make and very controversial. This is the same kind of statement, very brave move, one that he's going to be praised for and vilified for. I'm glad he did it. Now, dash of skepticism. It really means nothing more than the Bear Ears Memorial that Obama set up if he doesn't actually move the embassy. He's got to move the embassy, because otherwise the next president can come in and go, yeah, I don't know what he was crazy. So you got to move the embassy, and you got to move it before he's out of office, which, I mean, God knows, it could be another 6 years. It could be tomorrow. We don't know. So he's got to move the embassy. But as of yesterday, I stand corrected, and I'm happy to have been wrong on this one.
It's Thursday, December 7th. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
So Stu brought in a book that he was reading and said, you're going to love this. Hitler's American Model. It has Hitler in it. It's got the Nazis. Of course I'm going to love this. The United States and the Making of Nazi Race Law. This is a really important book for several reasons, none of which, because of the person who authored it, a professor at Yale Law, James Whitman. It is a very thoughtful book, a scholarly book, and one that I think he's... and he's probably not overcautious. I'm just too reckless. He makes the point over and over and over and over again. This does not mean the Americans were Nazis or anything else. It just is documenting how much the Nazis loved our racist laws from the Jim Crow days and the progressive era. Not good. James Whitman is with us now, author of Hitler's American Model. How you holding up, James?
Hello.
Yes.
Thanks for having me on the show.
You bet. How are you holding up?
Oh, pretty well. You know, the book is keeping me busy, I got to say.
Yeah, I bet it is. I would imagine that there's many people on the right that are saying this is nothing but an America bashing book, and those on the left that maybe are in denial that they don't want to see you expose, you know, FDR for, you know, his, you know, the outdated thinking of that era.
Well, it's certainly true that the book has created some discomfort on the left. There's no doubt about that. You know, although there are people on the far left who have been quite excited about what I have to say in the book. It's true enough, though, that when the Nazis were looking at the U.S. in the early 1930s, my book is only about the early 1930s, it was in an era of substantial Nazi interest in the New Deal administration and an occasional admiration for Franklin Roosevelt. That's absolutely true. and a little bit hard to swallow, obviously, for a lot of Americans now.
Stu, read the. This is just on page six. Read the thing that you brought in today on page six.
We have now long known the strange fact that the Nazis frequently praised Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal government in the early 1930s. FDR received distinctly favorable treatment in the Nazi press until at least 1936 or 37, lauded as a man who had seized dictatorial powers and embarked on bold experiments in the spirit of the Führer. Similar things were said more broadly about what was sometimes labeled in the 1930s the fascist New Deal. The glossy Berlin Illustrated magazine, seized from a Jewish publisher and converted to a kind of Nazi life magazine, ran heroic photo spreads on Roosevelt, while Nazi rags like Will and Power, the newsletter of the Hitler Youth, described him as a revolutionary who might fail only because he lacked a disciplined party army like our Führer.
So defend Roosevelt in some regard, this was the new kind of thought that had, you know, come from Germany in the 1800s to America. This idea of a strong state and fascism had not been discredited yet, if you will, like it was under Hitler. So nobody wants to really recognize that, though, James, do they?
You know, I can't speak for anybody else, but the facts are there. I mean, it's important to say that the Nazis were wrong about whether FDR
yes.
was a fascist, just as they were wrong about a lot of other things.
Correct.
You know, and it's also important to say that Germany, like the U.S., was facing the Great Depression. In some ways, it's not surprising that they came up with some similar programs. Programs that, you know, are now regarded as not very effective, but at the time were the best people could come up with. So, you know, this is not a story of you know, deep blood brotherhood between and Franklin Roosevelt or anything like that.
No,
the other thing you have to emphasize in all of this is that Roosevelt, especially in the early 30s, again, depended entirely on the support of the segregationist Southern Democratic Party.
So here's the thing that, and you do a really good job. I mean, for me, I'm a little more reckless. that's why you're a Yale professor. You do a good job of all the way through saying this does not mean this. We're not comparing the two, et cetera, et cetera. It's a very thoughtful book. But when you get into the Nuremberg laws, I mean, I have, you know, studied the progressive movement and its entanglement in eugenics. For a long, long time, I was not aware of all of the things that you exposed in the Nuremberg laws. I mean, they really looked at our laws to round up Jews.
Yeah, they sure did. I mean, you know, it's important to emphasize that in the early 30s, so the Nuremberg laws date to 1935, the idea of mass extermination or the Holocaust was not in anybody's head yet. I mean, the Nazis were simply trying to, the Nazis were trying to introduce forms of persecution short of death camps. You really have to remember that. And what the Nuremberg laws involved in particular was the creation of a new form of second-class citizenship for Jews and bans on sex and marriage between Jews and, you know, Aryans, as the Nazis defined them. And in those respects, there were all kinds of interesting things to look at in American law in the period, and they did.
You know, I want to take issue with one thing that you said, or maybe you can clarify, that nobody was thinking about gas chambers yet. In some ways, they were. I mean, George Bernard Shaw is shockingly deeply into this and talks about an actual gas chamber or some way of humanely putting people down that were no longer worth or worthy of the support of the mass of people. And that was in England right after the turn of the century. I mean, there was this idea of let's get rid of people, you know, and Theodore Roosevelt, so let me take on a Republican, wrote at some point we're going to be looked at like a crazy cattle rancher who would just let his best stock breed with the worst stock. We don't allow that to happen. Why would we now? And others took it further to extermination.
Yeah, those are appalling quotes. Yeah, it's not that the Nazis, and Hitler in particular, might not in principle have gone along with that sort of thing. But in the early 30s, it wasn't a practical possibility for them.
Right.
You know, exactly why they eventually turned to the death camps under cover of war, really, in World War II, is a subject of great debate among historians. I don't address that problem in the book, but
right.
In the early 30s, this just couldn't possibly have been a program they could have gotten through in Germany, and they didn't talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, it was really one of those things that this is what they believed they could get away with at the time, the leadership. And what is so disturbing about that is one of the reasons they thought they could get away with this part of it, the Nuremberg Laws, was because, hey, here's this other country. They're advanced. They're a top world country, you know, first world country, and they're doing these things. It was something that they could bring with justification of the United States and their policy as a backing to these were sensible laws. People were doing this all over the world.
Yeah, you bet. And not only people, not only another first world country, but the most powerful country in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of course, when the Nazis tried to understand how the U.S. had risen to the whatever measure of world domination had at the time, they figured it's obviously American racism that's made the country so successful. What else would Nazis conclude?
So there's also a story that you write about that I had no idea. They actually used a judge in New York who was an activist judge who very rightly stood up and talked about the Nazis when a ship came in. However, he kind of overreached his position. But that's kind of what set the Nuremberg Laws really in place, is it not?
That sure is. It's a heck of a story, really. Yeah, this was a Jewish judge, a really minor figure in American law. He was actually a magistrate in the Tombs, the detention center in Manhattan.
It was like a night court judge, right?
A night court judge.
Right.
What happened was there had been a riot in which the rioters tore the swastika flag off a Nazi, a German ocean liner and threw it into the Hudson River. The rioters had been arrested. They came before him, and he released them and issued a statement denouncing Nazism, which he had no business doing whatsoever.
Right.
Not what a night court judge is supposed to be doing.
Right.
But this, the Nazis seized on this as an insult, as justification for making the swastika flag at last the sole flag of Germany, and as the reason for promulgating these Nuremberg Laws. So the Nuremberg Laws were indeed the Nazi response to this, you know, in many ways admirable, but completely legally unjustified opinion delivered by a night court judge.
So James, did that play into, we're talking to Yale law professor James Whitman, author of the book Hitler's American Model. Did that incident play in at all with the idea that the Jewish community should just remain quiet, don't cause trouble here in America? Did people see that at the time in the Jewish community at all of, oh, crap. I mean, you did the wrong thing, but you said the right thing. And look at the trouble. It's made things worse now in Germany.
Not that I know of. In fact, he became something of a hero, not just in the U.S., but in France. He sailed off to France and was celebrated as a champion of the values of humanity against the threat of Nazism. I don't think people were yet thinking that it was important to keep quiet at that stage in 1935.
What was the thing that, as you're doing your research, you shake your head and you say, I can't believe how wrong we have history, or I can't believe this happened and nobody really knows.
Yeah, well, that was my reaction, I have to say. You know, I didn't expect to find the stuff that I found. But boy, did it turn out that there's a lot of it. In particular, I mean, I started just by, out of curiosity, looking at Mein Kampf, in which one finds the phrase, there is one country that has made progress toward the creation of a healthy race order, and that country was the United States. So Hitler was praising the U.S. already in Mein Kampf. And when you start to track down the legal records in the early 30s, it's all over the place, including we have a stenographic transcript of a planning meeting for the Nuremberg Laws. And the meeting begins when the Minister of Justice presents a memorandum on American law, and they discuss what lessons they can learn from the U.S. there.
So, James, why, you know, this is going to make people uncomfortable. I like books and thinking that makes me uncomfortable. It makes me grow, makes me think. And makes me question, why is this important that we learn this?
First of all, it's just a big part of American and world history. You know, This is no insignificant thing. And it does help us it doesn't help us explain why Hitler happened or anything like that. I mean, I think Hitler would have happened regardless.
Yeah.
But it does help us understand the course of development. And to come back to something you said earlier, it shows that the extent to which, in the early 1930s, creating a race order of that kind was quasi-respectable.
Yeah, you know? Yeah,
I mean,
it was.
Which is easy for us to forget. It tells us things about the U.S. too, about the history of American racism. So the Nazis weren't just interested in Jim Crow segregation. It turns out that there was racist law of all kinds, in American immigration law, for example, not all of it directed against blacks. It was a vast national body of law, not just limited to the South, and that's something we've forgotten too. And that's important to see that. You know, I think it also tells us things about where the dangers lie in the American values and American traditions. The things the Nazis liked so much in the 30s are still with us in some ways, even though segregation is gone. Even though there's no more Jim Crow.
James, thank you very much. It's a great read and something that everybody, I think, should have in their home library, and not something that you're necessarily going to drill down in anyplace else. And I hope this furthers the conversation about who we have been and the mistakes that we've made and how others have capitalized on that.
Well, thanks so much. I really appreciate the kind words.
You got it. Bye-bye.
Glenn Beck.
So I got up this morning, and Bitcoin had an alert that it was 14.9. When I went to sleep last night, it was fiddling around 12.9. I get up and it was 14.9. Then I take a shower on the way to work and get another alert. It's down to 13.6. Then I get ready to start the show and it was at 14.5 or 14.8. We just checked now and Bitcoin is at
16,937.
It has grown by 20% in the last 24 hours.
30%
in the last 24 hours. Now, this makes me nervous. And there's two ways to look at this. One, it's a bubble and it's growing way too fast. However, this is a global thing. I mean, you know, South Korea is, I mean, everybody is. Yeah, everybody's getting into Bitcoin in South Korea. So there's a lot of money going in around the world, but it's still a very little amount of money for the market. However, something happens on Sunday that could make Bitcoin go to 2,000, 8,000, could go to 40,000 or 80,000. I mean, I don't know. I don't know. People are saying that, you know, the time to really make money on Bitcoin is over. I'm not so sure. I mean, it might be. It also might go to 100,000 a coin. Because of what happens Sunday and then again a few days later. And we'll explain this. But if you put $100 into Bitcoin, you know, when we told you a few months ago, you're having a good day today.
Glenn Beck. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
So, you put money in Bitcoin. And
deal with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, everyone's like, oh, why are you talking about Bitcoin? You got to deal with it.
You got to have to deal with it for a few days.
Because here, you know, you wish you dealt with it back when we were in 2014 and 15 blabbing on about this. And you were like, oh, geez, I'm turning the radio. We have so many people in that are it actually makes me feel really good.
It does.
Because, you know, these stupid things, and I know nobody else talks about this, and I know it's nerdville, but it's like people in this audience are making fortunes.
Fortunes.
I mean, and that is really exciting. Again, we're not financial advisors. We don't know. We've said a million times this could go to zero tomorrow, and we may lose it all. But, we've talked to so many regular people who are like, you know what, I had $1,000 to throw in on this, and now I paid off a year worth of college that I would not be able to do. You know, people who have made incredible amounts of money from, you know, that heard us talking about this mm-hmm. and then have looked into it. And it's just, you know, so you get a couple of days where you feel.
So here's the problem. Anybody who put money into it and you look at that now and you go, okay, I was willing to walk away from the money that I put up.
Right. Like you put $1,000 in.
Yeah.
I was willing to walk away from that $1,000.
Am I willing to walk away with from 16? you know,
that's a lot of money,
yeah. And so you're kind of like, because I'm in this place now where I'm like, okay, I said let's just put it in there, and we're willing to lose it. Well, you know, pigs get slaughtered.
They do.
I mean, that's a lot of money, and so anyway. Here's what's happening. I would have left my money, and I still have it in there, and I probably will. I would be fine leaving it if the growth had even been as crazy as it had been
over the last year,
from January to November, but from Thanksgiving to today, it's crazy. It's crazy.
You want a nice little illustration? First of all, the market cap has passed some of the biggest companies you'd ever hear of, like Home Depot, for example. Bitcoin is considerably larger now than Home Depot. You know, have there been $300 billion companies that have gone bankrupt? Yes. Very few of them. You can count them on two hands at least.
But this really isn't a company.
It's not a company. It's something different.
This is a computer.
It could be something different, right? Yeah. Well, but I mean, it has gone up so much so fast, and you know, you wonder, is it sustainable? I don't know that it is.
So I printed this last night. Okay, last night. So Stu, you're going to have to help me because it stops at 14,000. Yeah. From 0 to 1,000, Bitcoin took 1,789 days. Mm-hmm. From 1,000 to 2,000, 1,271. From 2,000 to 3,000. 23 days. From 3 to 4, 62. 4 to 5, 61. 5 to 6, it took 8 days. 6 to 7, it took 13. 7 to 8, 14. 8 to 9, 9 days. 9 to 10, 2 days. 10 to 11, 1 day. 11 to 12, 6 days. 12 to 13, 17 hours. I printed this last night at like 10 o'clock. 13 to 14, 4 hours. That's where it left off.
Yeah, and since that happened, it's gone up, $3,000 more? I mean, it's right near 17,000 as we speak. Again, it's an incredible thing.
It's nuts.
And yeah, look, is this a bubble? I think probably this part of it, it's not good. I mean, well, when
let me,
it hit 10,000, I...
Let me make a case for both. Here's what could be happening. What could be happening is everybody starting to wake up going, I got to get on that Bitcoin train. Okay, that's the worst possible thing, because then it's definitely a bubble and it will come down. Okay. The second could be, on Sunday, they're opening this up for large investors. So for the first time, institutional investors will be able to buy Bitcoin, and a futures market begins. Now, we're going to explain this at 5 o'clock today so you understand, but that's basically going to the craps table. And you're just betting on the guy rolling the dice. Is he going to roll a six or is he not?
Yeah.
And you're not really rolling the dice. You have nothing in it. You're just betting on that guy's not going to continue to win. So the futures market starts. That generally will push the price of things down, especially because I believe a lot of people with a lot of money are very interested in making sure that Bitcoin is destroyed. So it could mean that Sunday it all is going to fall apart, and it's just irrational exuberance right now. But it also could be, get in, because Sunday is the beginning, the first round of institutional investors, meaning, like, you know, I'm just making this one up. The California Teachers Union could say, I'm not getting a good, rate of growth here at all in whatever we're invested in. I'm going to put 1% of this into Bitcoin. This is a good bet. Well, all of that money from these big institutions can pour in beginning Sunday. That could mean that Bitcoin on Sunday, because of the futures market, could go to 8,000, could go to 2,000. It could mean that because of the institutional venture investments, it could go from, at this rate, Sunday it'll be at 25,000 to 50,000 or 100,000 when the institutional investors get in. It's feast or famine.
Yeah, and it's certainly what the we've had people on before that are big believers in this, and they, you know, we're talking about $1 million per Bitcoin, and that sounds ridiculous, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It sounded ridiculous for a long time. Right now, that number is 58. 58 Bitcoins is $1 million. So it's not, it's, you know, what is, like, we're getting to the point where, I mean, it's pretty amazing, right? I mean, like, it used to be, when we started out this year, it was 1,000.
It's just moving so fast.
Bitcoins?
Yeah.
It's 58. To get $1 million, you know, again, this stuff, I don't know how long it lasts. I mean,
I've
never seen anything like it.
I've never seen anything like this in my life. And I mean, I would imagine that the last time something this dramatic happened was 1929.
But again, like, that's it. Like, the internet bubble keep appearing up. 1929 is another interesting one,
yep.
Right? Was that a bubble? Both of those were, I don't know. 1929 is a weird one because there's a lot of different things going on. But if you go to the internet bubble, it's a good example. The internet bubble was a bubble. It's also 1/1,000th of what the internet is today.
So if I were a betting man, and clearly I am because I've bought money in Bitcoin, if I were a betting man, here's what I think. I think the institutional investors and everything else, the futures market, is going to, it might drive it up. I don't know what's going to happen when it first goes in, irrational exuberance. I have no idea. But I think it will come down because of the futures market, and it will make it more stable. So let's just say, you know, it goes down to 8,000. Well, then it will be 8,000, and it will slowly build to 9 and slowly build to 10 if it's real. I think, you know, it just like, you know what? Bitcoin may be the pets.com of blockchain. Because what you really invest, what's interesting about Bitcoin is blockchain, this idea of currency that is digitized, completely safe,
and
easy to use, and decentralized.
And it's not just currency. It's all sorts of different things.
Right. So that's what's driving it. Blockchain, if you will, is the internet. The question is Bitcoin pets.com? If you're looking at the, and you're saying this is a dot-com bubble. The internet didn't go away. Blockchain's not going to go away.
Yeah.
Digital currency won't go away.
I don't think Bitcoin is the pets.com. There are thousands of cryptocurrencies.
That are.
Many of those that are the bit.com.
Yes.
But I mean, if you look at, this has happened with Bitcoin in 2014. You know, it rose from nothing to over $1,000 in about 2014. And people were like, this is a bubble. It's ridiculous. It was. It went up, and irrational exuberance took over for a short period of time, went up to 1,200, 1,300, and it fell back to 200, and it stayed at 200 for a couple of years. Years! When Donald Trump was coming down the escalator, it was $500. Now it's 17,000 almost, or 16,000 and change. The point being, though, just because it has these bubbles does not mean it's going away.
No.
And it may very well crash down tomorrow or in two days.
And it could very well double. It could very well double. It could double. It could almost double today at the rate it's going.
It's hard to even see the bubble from 2014 in the chart anymore. It's gone up so much.
It's really, I've nothing in my life. Is there anything in your life like this?
No, I mean, it's funny because, you know, and we've seen this with so many people in the audience, and you go your whole life without being part of one of these.
Yeah.
One of these things.
And it's kind of fun.
It's fun. Yeah. I mean, you know, obviously you always look back. It's very easy to look back at the negative. People are more, you know, every time we talk about this stuff, I'm like, why didn't I put a lot of money into this?
Oh, I know. Jeez, I know. I looked at it today and I was like, oh, you got to be kidding.
It would have been really meaningful.
Yeah.
Right. But it's still, it's fun. And whatever amount you put in, you made a lot more than you've put in. And you still, to this day, as we will say over and over again, shouldn't put in any money you don't mind losing on. You know, Glenn, you put it a nice way of like, well, you know, if you're going to go out for a nice night or a nice weekend out and you can skip one of them, it's worth that much money.
I think it is still worth that much money. Because there's a chance that this still goes up to 100,000, goes up to 1 million. You know, I mean, I don't know.
It could.
The question is, do you have the guts? Do you have a number, Stu, that you're like, if it hits this, I am out?
Oh, we've passed like several of those.
I know.
This is what always happens with these things.
I know.
As you've pointed out. One interesting thing, there's analysis that I was reading recently that said, Bitcoin, is it going to take over the world? I don't know. Maybe not. Probably not, right? Can it become 1%, however, of financial instruments? You know what I mean? Like, obviously, it's be much smaller than gold, for example, which is a mm-hmm. much more stable, realistic thing. Mm-hmm. We've talked about that a million times. Can it be 1%, however, of financial instruments? If it's 1%, the price for Bitcoin is roughly $40,000. So that is something that you look at and you're like, okay, $40,000, 1%, 2%, 3%, are those completely insane? Probably not.
Not.
Right. And then you're talking about real run-ups. I don't think that that's near-term stuff, honestly. But I certainly didn't see this either. So I have no idea.
So, Stu, if the, let's say, the California Teachers Union decided to, as an institution, invest 1% of their holdings into Bitcoin, at this point, one giant institution could make a huge impact. Would they not?
Yeah, I mean, it could. It also opens up to, I mean, a run-up like this combined with, like, if a teacher's union gets involved and dump a bunch of money in this, and in 6 months it's half of what it's worth, you will see all sorts of calls for regulation.
Yeah, I think this. I think this is going to be, because stuff like this always leaves wreckage. Do not put money in that you don't have or cannot afford. Do not do that. Don't. This is crazy town. If you have money that you're going to blow on something else, if you and your wife are like, you know what, honey, let's not do Christmas, you know, just you and I, we don't need anything anyway. Let's just take the money that we were going to spend on us and let's put that in Bitcoin. Do that. Don't dump a lot of money into it, because this is unprecedented. And, you know, the tulip thing that happened in the 1500s. Where people were exchanging money, and then somebody's like, you know, I got this nice tulip. And he was like, oh my gosh. Well, I'll give you a farthing for that, whatever that's worth. And all of a sudden it was worth 1 million farthings. It happened in a month. The run-up went up and crashed and wiped people out. And we're still talking about the tulip mania from the 1500s. Don't get swept up into Bitcoin mania. Be smart.
And if you figure out what smart is, tell us.
Tell us. Let us know.
Glenn Beck.
Everything you need to know tonight. At 5 o'clock, we're going to be covering Al Franken's possible resignation. Also, Bitcoin and the futures market. What does that mean exactly? We do that 5 o'clock only on the Blaze TV.
Glenn Beck.